radio, and the internet.
TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio. Now more of the Wild About Pets radio show on TalkZone.com. Once again, here's Susan Frank.
Welcome back to the show, sponsored by Nutrisource, a super premium pet food. I'm talking to Melanie Joy, author of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. Our phone lines are open. It's April 8th. Call 1-888-463-6748. I'll repeat that. It's 888-463-6748, or email me at susan@wildaboutpets.net to ask Dr. Joy a question about the choices we make and how we come to accept eating certain animals and not eating other ones. We'd love to hear your questions and your stories. We're looking at photograph number 10 right now, Dr. Joy, and this shows a photograph of you, and it looks like a large pig at a place called the Farm Sanctuary. I'm wondering how, since you said that you started out as a meat eater, how did you come to write this book?
Well, it was interesting, and as I explained, I did grow up with a dog who I really loved like a family member, and had two dogs actually. When I was 13, my first dog died, and we adopted another dog. So I had always really had a pet who I had felt very connected to. And I know along the way I had been exposed to information that really illuminated the horrors of animal agriculture, but I hadn't been ready to take in that information. Mm-hmm. So my response had been for many years, you know, please don't tell me that, you'll ruin my meal. And in 1989, I got quite sick. I awoke to find myself hooked up to IV antibiotics at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston after having eaten what turned out to be my very last hamburger. I had contracted Campylobacter, which is the sister disease of Salmonella. And I really, after that experience, I never wanted to eat meat again.
I can imagine.
And it was a terrible experience. It was one of the worst experiences of my life, but it was also one of the best experiences of my life because it was a turning point for me. After I stopped eating meat, I made the connection. You know, I had a shift of consciousness. Or a paradigm shift. I didn't see different things. I saw the same things differently. So, you know, with my golden retriever example, the way that meat suddenly looks to people who would normally find a beef stew delicious, that's the way all meat suddenly looked to me. And I really became interested in what had happened to me. How was it possible for people like me who are caring, rational people, whose core value system certainly doesn't support the, completely unnecessary and often intensive suffering of other animals. How is it possible for people like me to, you know, in the words of psychiatrist and social activist Robert J. Lifton, just stop thinking when it comes to eating animals? And this really motivated me to start my research. Along the way, I was continuing to learn about the plight of the animals that become our food, and I became increasingly inspired to really raise awareness about not just what was happening to the animals in the world, but the impact of our choices to eat them on ourselves as well. Because looking back on my own life, I could see that I was living so far out of alignment with my core value system. Mm-hmm. And it was very empowering for me to make that connection and to feel that I was living more authentically as who I am, rather than who I've been taught to be.
Mm-hmm. So are you now a vegetarian?
I am. I'm actually a vegan now.
And let's define that. What is the difference between the two terms?
Well, a vegetarian, I became a vegetarian after getting Campylobacter, so I stopped eating all meat, and I actually stopped eating eggs at the time. But some vegetarians, or vegetarians by definition, eat eggs and or dairy products. But they don't eat meat. They don't eat flesh products. Vegans don't eat any animal products. And I was able to continue eating dairy products for a long time because I wasn't aware of the fact that the dairy industry, like the egg industry, is essentially, you know, one of the most brutal industries of all. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had not eaten veal for much of my life, even when I was a meat eater, on the grounds that doing so was inhumane. What I didn't realize is that the veal industry is driven by the dairy industry.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I became aware, I think it's because it's possible to procure dairy products and eggs, for instance, without causing intensive harm to the animals, it's easier for us to justify eating these products. But the reality is that when somebody is a unit of production, which is the case for the animals who are, you know, bred and killed for our food, their welfare will always be secondary to the profits their bodies will turn. And all animal products are products of suffering and brutality. It took me about 9 years to make the dairy connection, but I did eventually become a vegan.
In your book, you do have a chapter called The Way Things Really Are that does go into more of the explicit and graphic stories or explanations of what does happen in the slaughterhouses. And we're not going to get into those details right now. And I love at one point you mentioned, Dr. Joy, that you ask for people to inform themselves, but you very compassionately and sensitively mentioned that there's a way to become informed without necessarily having to expose yourself to highly disturbing and traumatic information. And I think we come to that in our own terms, in our own way. And there is so much of wealth in this book beyond that. And there are some eye-opening aspects about what you are saying, the suffering and what the experience is. So I encourage people to know that it's there. We'll only touch on it today because I, again, want to look at the overall picture. But you're right. There's a lot that I think people don't want to know and they could not know in order to continue eating meat.
That's true. And that's really kind of the great paradox of carnism. Carnism would not need to use the defenses it uses if people actually didn't care. And the reason that we have to go through all the psychological acrobatics in order to eat animals is because we do care. Our caring is both the problem and the solution. Our caring is what makes us want to turn away from the painful realities of carnism. But our caring is also what can give us the courage to see the truth or to bear witness to what's really happening.
Yes, there's a remarkable story. This is actually photograph number 15 about Emily the cow. Can you tell us the story of Emily the cow and what came to light because of her story?
Well, sure. Emily the cow, in November 1995, Emily the cow was in a lineup of bovines in a New England slaughterhouse, and she was awaiting her turn to, you know, be brought onto the kill floor. And nobody knows why this actually happened, but Emily suddenly charged out of the line, sprinted toward the 5-foot-high fence that corralled the grounds, and jumped over the top of the fence. And she's a 1,500-pound cow. And she fled through the woods and was able, you know, for 40 frigid days and nights to elude the workers who had chased after her, to elude the police that were looking for her. The reason that she was able to stay away from them and not be caught was because the locals, this is in Hopkinton, Massachusetts, a small town in Massachusetts, the locals were aiding her. And they would give police misleading information as to her whereabouts, and local farmers would leave out bales of hay for her so that she could be fed. And eventually she was discovered by Lewis and Megan Randa, who were the co-founders of the Peace Abbey in Sherburn, Mass., a neighboring town. And the Peace Abbey is a spiritual life center and also a vegan sanctuary for animals. They see veganism as inherently interconnected with the spiritual traditions that they support in their center. And they ended up buying Emily for $1 from the slaughterhouse owner, who agreed to give them, essentially give them the cow. And Emily became a symbol. She became a symbol of an individual who inspired compassion. She became a symbol of an individual cow who was willing to break out of the system that she was a part of. And people heard about Emily's story from all around the world. And it was very interesting and inspirational because many people said that they stopped eating meat just upon learning about Emily the cow. And she lived out her life at the Peace Abbey. And you know, there's now a statue erected in her benefit called Emily the Sacred Cow. It's a life-sized bronze statue. And the reason I included Emily's story is because it's really striking. These people who were helping Emily stay in the woods for 40 days and nights, these were not vegans or vegetarians. They were meat eaters who were able to make that connection because she was an individual.
Sure, and we all basically really do care about other living things, and we care about animals. By the way, we have a caller. Cully, go ahead with your question for Dr. Joy.
Hi, Dr. Joy. This is Cully. I recently had the honor of listening to one of your lectures in Tampa, Florida.
Hi, Cully.
And how are you? I had a question about the invisible belief system. One of the troubling things for me as a vegan when I watch television is dozens of times per day I see television commercials that show families and friends gathering around at a restaurant, of course, eating animals. And I know that PETA and other organizations have tried to buy commercial time on primetime TV in the past, and they haven't had much success for fear of advertiser backlash. But I was wondering if they were able to purchase commercial time on primetime television, would the invisible belief system disappear?
That's a great question. The belief system, carnism, is so entrenched. When a system is entrenched, it means it's embraced and maintained by all major social institutions, from the family to the state. It's like literally woven into the structure of society. Invisibility, as I describe in my book, is actually the primary defense of the system. You know, if we don't see it, if we don't, one of the ways the system remains invisible is by remaining unnamed. If we don't name it, we can't talk about it. If we can't talk about it, we can't question it. We can't challenge it. And the invisibility of carnism is why eating meat appears to be a given rather than a choice. But carnism, as you point out, Cully, also relies on practical invisibility. You know, keeping the victims, the animal victims and the impact on, you know, humans, human consumers, for instance, and the environment out of sight and conveniently out of public consciousness. So everything that we can do to pierce the veil of invisibility, to challenge this assumption that eating meat, for instance, is normal, it's natural, it's necessary, is absolutely a step in the right direction. And this is happening, not so much on primetime TV, but it is happening because the number of organizations that are promoting veganism and challenging carnism is growing. And the number of restaurants, you know, offering vegan options and stores offering vegan foods is also growing. So in answer to your question, yes, absolutely, but that would be one piece of the whole.
Thank you very much for your question, Cully. Actually, there are a couple other questions that have just been emailed in. By the way, Dr. Joy, were you finished with that answer?
I was.
Okay. So here's one from Jeff from Illinois. You describe in your book carnism as somewhat exploitative. How would you describe Native Americans and how they were omnivores?
Well, that's a question that I get asked a lot. Carnism applies to those of us who have the luxury of reflecting on our choices, which is the case for much of the world today. When people do not have the luxury of reflecting on their choices, when it's not a choice, when eating animals is a necessity for survival, then you know, there's a very different relationship people have with the act of eating animals. Having said that, anthropologists and historians have found that even in societies where, you know, so gathering hunting societies, for instance, or, you know, Native American societies, there has consistently been a moral discomfort with the idea of killing other humans and killing animals. And so one of the ways around this, for instance, has been to have sometimes elaborate rituals, spiritual cleansing rites, for instance, after killing an animal. Sometimes the people who killed the animals for the rest of society would be classified as in a caste of untouchables, for instance, where, you know, the butchers would be considered morally impure, and they would either have to purify themselves before integrating back into the community or relating with others in the community, or they would be kept completely separate from the community. So we can see that there have been justifications throughout history and across cultures, even when it comes to those who need to eat animals in order to survive. So I do believe that the moral discomfort is always there. But my concern is much more with people who have, most of the people or many of the people in the world today who don't eat animals because we have to. We eat animals because we choose to. We eat animals simply because we like the way their bodies taste.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's another comment and question from Michael from Iowa. He writes, "It seems that for many of my meat-eating friends and family members, it's a very macho thing to eat meat, steaks, burgers, hot dogs, etc. How do we get carnists to embrace a more compassionate, less macho diet?"
Well, that's another great question. There is a growing body of literature that is examining the connection between meat and masculinity. There's a classic book written in the early 1990s by Carol Adams called The Sexual Politics of Meat, where she explores how meat has traditionally been considered to be a masculine food and continues to be today. And I think some of this really is about reframing the issue. And reframing, how we think of masculinity. Meat is often, well, let me back up for a minute, but how we think of masculinity, we can look at the choice to be a conscientious objector to an exploitive practice as heroic, as opposed to feminized. And there's also, in my book I talk about what I refer to as the three ends of justification. Eating meat is normal, natural, and necessary. This is part of the mythology of meat that keeps the system intact. And one of these ends, eating meat is necessary, is often connected with the myths about physical necessity. So even though, for instance, the American Dietetic Association, which is the preeminent, organized body of professional dietitians in the country, has issued a statement saying that vegan diets are not only, nutritionally adequate, but likely even healthier in that they can help prevent disease, we still often tend to believe that eating meat is necessary for health. In particular, when it comes to protein.
Yes.
And this is where it gets, is even more connected with this idea of masculinity. We think of eating somebody else's muscles as making us more muscular. And what's striking about this protein myth is that in the so-called developed world today, protein deficiency is virtually unheard of. And protein excess is becoming an increasing concern among medical doctors as it's linked with obesity and diabetes and various other problems. And so I think what we need to do is really work to dispel this protein myth. Plant-based proteins are considered by a number of experts now as, superior to animal-based proteins. Some of the strongest animals on the planet have never eaten any animal protein in their lives. Think of elephants and giraffes and hippos, for instance.
Mm-hmm. That's a question I know a lot of people who look a bit askance on vegetarians. They say, but, how do you get your proteins? And mixing the beans and the rice that, they used to promote all the time is difficult and you're going to be unhealthy. That's not true then, is it?
No, that is a myth. That's a long-standing entrenched myth that really continues to prop up the system of carnism.
Okay. One thing, though, Dr. Joy, that I encounter in doing my show and talking to a lot of people about animal nutrition regards cats. And if you're looking at cats and dogs, obviously cats are considered the true carnivores, and their bodies are designed to process and digest fats and proteins. And animal proteins is what even, I have learned. So do you agree that for some animals, like the true carnivores, they indeed do need to eat meat, as opposed to what you and I are saying about humans?
It's a fairly complicated issue. we are not carnivores, so we do not need to eat meat in order to survive. That's clear. And in fact, meat consumption and the consumption of animal products have been connected with the leading causes of disease in the Western world, everything from diabetes and heart disease to different various types of cancer and obesity. Cats are natural carnivores. Now, living in the society that we do, unfortunately, if we are to feed our cats flesh-based food products, it's likely that they're going to come from the very industry that some of us are trying not to support. And that's where it makes it a fairly complicated issue. I know of people who have purchased vegan food products for their cats that are supplemented in order to be digestible and nutritionally complete cat foods. I also know of a number of people who have continued to feed their cats flesh-based products mm-hmm. because they recognize that, you know, there's it's sort of like the perfect is the enemy of the good in a way, you know, in a way. So we do what we can, and we make choices that, you know, ideally are as in alignment with our core values as we can. And sometimes, I mean, when I had cats, I had sick cats. I couldn't put them on a diet that was not meat-based because they had some very serious health problems, and they had to be on a specific type of food. I didn't feel comfortable about that. But again, one of my responses when people bring up an issue like this is to say that really, you know, people would ask me, Melanie, where do you draw your line around your circle of compassion? You know, where, how far are you going to go with this?
Mm-hmm.
And I always respond, it's not where I draw my line that matters to me. It's how I relate to that line.
Yes.
One of the participants in a talk I recently gave said, you know, draw your line in pencil. So what I encourage people to do in my book is to reflect on their line rather than make all or nothing decisions.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to be talking about how we actually disguise our food. Stay tuned.